someone you love, wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Recent decades have seen the development of cell phones, internet, cable TV, GPS, computers, Google, Apple, MRI machines, amazing video games, cardiac stents. In addition to enhancing our lives, such technologies have created millions of jobs. So many of you who are work-oriented may be wondering, what's next? What's the next big thing? How can I get in on the ground floor? Well, one of my goals on Work with Marty Nemko is to help you, my dear listeners, to get in on the ground floor of the next big things. And to that end, my guest is Stephen Kotler. He is co-author with Pia Diamandis, the CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation. By the way, the XPRIZE Foundation awards up to $10 million for solutions to major societal problems. And the book distills a lot of what has been learned in the many, many applications that have come in for the XPRIZE. They've had the book addresses what the author believes are what's next for the important things like energy and food and water and health and education. The book's title, Abundance. The future is better than you think. Stephen Kotler, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Pleasure. Your book says that the world is on the precipice of another explosion in technology that'll soon bring refuge from many of our current problems and abundance to our doorstep. Well, that's been promised for decades, yet we still don't even have an adequate energy solution, let alone significant life extension. Much of the world still doesn't even have enough food and clean water. And robots? The Roomba notwithstanding, the vast majority of us still vacuum our carpets with a Hoover. Well, what makes you optimistic that this time is going to be different?
Well, I think there's two answers to your question, but the quick answer is not only are a number of very, very critical technologies now advancing exponential growth rates, but there are three other emerging forces that are appearing on the scene for the very first time, and we think it's the combination of these four forces that will really allow us to significantly increase global standards of living over the next 20 to 30 years.
Quickly trot out what you're most excited about in terms of the technological advancements and each of those three other things that you say are vectors that are going to be affecting
What's growing on exponential growth curves, and an exponential growth curve, for those who don't know, is like Moore's Law. Moore's Law was created back in 1965, and it says that the number of integrated circuits on a computer chip doubles every 12 to 24 months.
Right.
Now, this massive rate of progress is now showing up in biology, in robotics, in AI, all over healthcare, a number of other places, and this is really, really allowing technology to advance at ridiculous rates.
Just a little caveat before you go on. I have read that while Moore's Law traditionally had been about doubling the amount of processing power, now that we have really, that the computer chips have reached the basic physics limitation, so it's no longer a matter that we're going to increase the power of an individual chip. We're merely layering on more chips and, you know, smaller, more chips onto a, or more, I don't know, more semiconductors onto a chip. Is that accurate?
That is pretty accurate, but you have to, Ray Kurzweil sat down and looked at kind of all these exponential growth patterns over a very, very long period of time. And one of the things he discovered is anytime we start to come to the end of an exponential pattern, another paradigm-changing technology shows up. And this has been consistent for over 100 years. For example, vacuum tubes were replaced by silicon. So whatever limits we may be approaching, chances are there's another technology that's poised to take its place.
I think that's absolutely right, except when we reach the physics limitations. When two electrons can't be brought closer together or you're going to create a reaction, I think there we have an actual physics delimiting force. But let's not get we're getting into the weeds.
We go into quantum computing next and the whole show's going south.
Right, exactly, completely. So you said there are three vectors, three factors.
Three other forces that are really important.
Right.
The first of these is the kind of the newfound power of the do-it-yourself, the DIY innovator. For the first time really in history, DIY innovators can take on the kinds of grand challenges that not just 20 years ago were the sole property of large corporations.
These are do-it-yourselfers. These are talking about the garage entrepreneurs, the garage innovators.
The garage innovators, the garage entrepreneurs. I mean, think about, you know, when Peter's XPRIZE, for example, the very first one, right? NASA spent billions of dollars trying to get us into space with thousands of people, and they eventually abandoned, you know, most of that because it was just too expensive for them, right? And Burt Rutan comes along, wins the X Prize with $26 million and literally a garage full of mechanics, like 25 guys, and put a man into space. That's incredible. And, but that's just kind of the beginning. If you go to this year's iGEM competition with the synthetic, 2008 iGEM competition, which is synthetic biology, what you find is a class of high school and college students from Slovenia who invented, using synthetic biology, a real-world vaccine against the most common form of ulcers. This is high school and college students working in their garage. So nothing like this has ever happened before. So that's the first of our
four. And that is abetted by the second one that you're going to mention, which is that there are a lot of tech philanthropists. I don't mean donating money, but the whole notion of open-sourced genomes, open-sourced information about proteins, enables somebody in a garage to take data that may have cost billions of dollars, or excuse me, millions of dollars to develop and can incorporate it. And then the use of technology, which has become so cheap, relatively speaking, enables them to make discoveries that would only have been possible by big corporations. Is
that
fair? I got
to tell you a crazy story. I don't know if you've heard the Foldit story. Do you know what Foldit is?
Remind me.
Okay, so amino acids are two-dimensional. They get folded into three-dimensional structures as proteins.
Right.
Protein structure defines its function. So how they fold up into proteins is really critical for drug discovery, medical advances, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Until very recently, it was a supercomputer program. Mm-hmm. Then the guys, a bunch of scientists at the University of Washington in Seattle, created a game called Foldit, and it turns out the human brain's pattern recognition system is better at folding proteins than supercomputers are, at least right now.
That,
right?
I didn't know. Uh-huh. Okay.
So they, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have signed up to play. Major advances in AIDS and AIDS research and things like that have happened because of this. But when they went and looked, who's the world's greatest protein folder? They didn't find a Caltech student or an MIT professor. They found a middle-aged woman from Manchester, England, who during the day is an executive secretary at a rehab clinic.
Wow.
And at night is the world's greatest protein.
Amazing. That is a great story. Talk about a Superman, Clark Kent and Superman at night.
Totally, right?
Right. Okay, so that leads us to your second of the three vectors that makes you optimistic. Let me finish. This leads us to the second of the three vectors that leads you to optimism that this time, indeed, technology may be our savior. What is the second one?
The second one is the techno-philanthropist, which is kind of the new breed philanthropist, and you've kind of hinted at this. But we've got a whole new kind of philanthropy going on right now. You've got private individuals with literally some of them have the resources of nation states. Matthew Bishop calls them hyper-agents. They don't face elections like politicians. They don't have shareholders demanding high returns. They don't have to spend all their time fundraising. So they're freed up to do really deep, long-term thinking, and that's exactly what happened. It's happening. You've got Bill Gates and malaria being the most obvious example. Jeff Skoll is crusading against pandemics and against nuclear proliferation. This list kind of goes on and on and on. And it's not just these, like the days of old where it was, I write the check and then I'm done. Now it's I write the check and I'm just getting started. And the amount of leverage these people are bringing is incredible. And on top of that, you've got to talk about here a little bit impact investing, because not only are these guys driving a lot of this change this way, they're investing in triple bottom line companies, and the dollar amounts are going up like crazy. A couple of years ago when we started writing Abundance, the most recent report said there was $50 billion in impact investing, and it's going to jump to $1 trillion by 2020, according to a recent report. That's a massive influx of capital into the system. And who are they funding? As you pointed out, a lot of those DIY innovators.
And you know what I find interesting? I haven't seen the Gates Foundation budget, but my feel, I spent a lot of time around the world of education. Their initial focus was, yes, it was inoculating all kids in Africa, but it was also the equal focus was education. I'm seeing a redirection away from that. Education has proved to be the education blob, the education bureaucracy has proved so intractable. And perhaps the limitations of education relative to what our wish it would be are too great. I believe that he's actually moving away from education. We're going to talk a little more about education later. But dear listeners, I want to let my listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm speaking with Stephen Kotler. He's the co-author of the book Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. What you may say, what in the world does this have to do with work? A lot. Because until It is in this ever tougher job economy, especially if you have the luxury of a little bit of time to plan ahead, or for your children or your adult grandchildren, getting a sense of what might at least be, have an educated guess as to maybe the next pockets of opportunity, the next ground floors, will help inform your decisions about what you, your child, or your adult grandchild should do, so that they do not suffer the job insecurity that so many people today are facing. Let's briefly talk about the third of the vectors, the third of the forces that you give you reason to have optimism that this time technology may indeed be the world savior.
Well, this is the force that both Peter and myself are absolutely the most excited about. And this is literally the poorest of the poor, the poorest people on earth, used to be called the bottom billion, and we have renamed the rising billion. And here's why. Right now, internet penetration globally, we've got a population of 7 billion just plus, 2 billion people are online. By 2020, that number is going to jump to 5 billion. That means in the next, 8 years, we're going to get access to 3 billion new minds we have never heard from before. People are joining the conversation who have never, ever, ever been heard from before. What will they want? What will they desire? You're talking about tens of trillions of dollars of annual purchasing power coming online for the first time. This is an astounding, astounding, astounding amount of, new influx into the global economy. And just to give you, just to bring this up to speed so you have an idea of what we're talking about, right now, Hollywood is a 100-year hegemony on entertainment. Right. They've owned it. They've owned every bit of it. Right now, there are more content developers in the developing world than there are in the developed.
Interesting. And yes, there is that. It is inconceivable that literally billions of people who have heretofore not been party to the, quote, tech development world, as cell phones become ubiquitous, as wireless computing becomes ubiquitous, that they won't ever more. And as the internet makes information accessible from Azerbaijan to Zambia, it is inconceivable that they won't be increasing contributors to technological solutions. It makes a lot of sense to me, Steve.
Well, you have to...
Go ahead.
Not to interrupt you, but one of the things we talk about in abundance, and it's so incredible for me every time I think about this. Right now, a Maasai warrior in the middle of Africa on a cell phone has access to better information and communication than President Reagan did 25 years ago.
Great
if
sound.
They're on Google with access to, with on a smartphone with access to Google, they've got better quality information and communications than the president did 15 years ago. That's Clinton.
Those are great sound bites. Let's turn now to specific verticals, as I teased at the top of the show. I'd like to hear both what's in the book as well as, if you can, I know you can't speak for Peter, but I know you've been very close contact with Peter, who is the founder and president of the XPRIZE, which gives away up to 10 million, up to 26 million bucks for solutions to major societal problems. So he's gotten a ton of proposals. So let's take the key world societal problems one at a time. And if you were betting your own dollars on which technology is going to have the most transformational effect, what would it be? Let's start with energy. What would you bet your most chips on in light of what all those proposals that have come in the X Foundation and what Peter's thinking and your thinking are?
Well, I have to mention very briefly fourth generation nuclear, and then we're going to move beyond that really quickly. But fourth generation nuclear is really, really interesting and solves all the massive problems of anything that's come before. So it's worth talking about.
Sure.
I'd rather focus on solar. Without question, this one goes to solar. It's abundant. It's just not accessible. You have to realize that 5,000 more times solar energy hits the Earth every day than we use in a year.
What I've been hearing about that is, I have spoken to physicists about this. That's one of my obsessions. I have a lot of obsessions, but one of them is energy. And I've spoken to physicists who do say that while solar is in theory abundant, it is so weak that in order for it to be a significant player in the world solution will require so much of America to be covered with these expensive, degradable solar panels, and there will be so much heat loss in the transmission that they are actually more optimistic about what you said first, fourth generation, much safer, much more compact nuclear, which is, by the way, speaking of Bill Gates has made a major investment in a very compact, small nuclear...
Maribel's traveling wave reactor, you're right.
Tell us about it, please, or push back and say why I'm wrong.
Well, I do think you're wrong, okay? I mean, the thing you have to realize about solar is cost dropped 50% last year. The rate of production is growing 30% a year. In India right now, Solar is now half of the cost of diesel. And a recent MIT study, February 2012, says by 2020 in sunny parts of the U.S., solar will be 6 cents a kilowatt hour versus 15 cents for the national electricity average. I also think – I'm not saying those physicists aren't wrong. Let's go back to your point, right? The way that solar panels have been made in the past, they're a mess. They're not they're a mess after you're done using them. They're hard to use. What's happening is they're getting denser and smaller and more lightweight and more durable. And we're really, really, really – the exponential growth curve that, you know, that has been impacting solar for a little while is – it's really starting to move forward. So I think a lot of the problems that people are seeing – and this, by the way, very common – when you talk energy, one of the things, and I'm sure you know this, a lot of people tend to base their predictions on where we are today or where the technology was when they first learned about it, and they don't often move forward. So I think what you're seeing with when you're bringing a lot of people to the equation is they're looking at, you know, essentially technology that's almost already obsolete.
Stephen, I've got to really push back here because I'm not looking retrospective. I'm looking prospectively, not just because the physicists are talking about the physics delimitation of solar because it's so diffuse, the amount of actual solar energy coming down in most parts of the world is so small, but also the ultimate index of looking forward of solar is stock prices, because stock prices are a forward-looking index and they represent the collective wisdom of the entire world. And if you look at the price of the solar stock index, there's something called there's an ETF, a market basket of solar stocks called SUNIDX. It's down from it reached its peak when President Obama got elected at 1,700, which, of course, because they knew he was going to subsidize it. Do you know what the price is now? 95% less. It's 128 or 130, down 95%. That's a forward-looking index. I cannot so blithely dismiss the collective wisdom of the world in betting all of its dollars against solar.
I don't think the entire world is betting all of its dollars.
Well, if the collective if the price is down 95%, the collective wisdom, the whole world is betting against it.
The other thing I don't have data to back up what I'm about to say, but if you ask me, because I've had this conversation, and I'm a guy who, as a science writer, I talk to editors all the time, so I have a pretty good sense of what the news is going to be. My articles get written 8 months ahead of time, 6 months ahead of time, so I pretty much know where we're going on a lot of these things ahead of time. And I noticed over the past, 5 years ago, everybody was wanting a solar article. Now, everybody wants articles about how solar hasn't delivered on its promises. There's something called the Gardner hype curve, and it usually shows up with almost any technology. There's a lot of hype. When we start hearing about a new technology, it's happened with the internet too. And then when it doesn't immediately deliver on all these, astounding promises, it crashes. And I think we're at the bottom of that crash right now. And I think over the next couple of years, the innovations are going to start getting realer. They're going to start hitting the market. And I think those numbers are going to go way back up.
I hope you're right.
If you ask me what I would bet on, I would bet on solar, but I'm happy to disagree with you.
Okay, let's turn to healthcare. Obviously, healthcare is going to be revolutionized by a better understanding of what genes control what health and disease processes. We're going to have individualized treatments and gene therapy to prevent and cure diseases from mental retardation to cancer. But they've been promising that for decades. And certainly, since Craig Venter decoded the genome a decade ago, we have not seen that promise yet come close to being realized. So, but what is your bet going forward about what's going to happen in the next decade?
Well, I have to back you up for half a second and say, yes, Venter decoded the genome 10 years ago at this point. But he did it, by the way, when we budgeted that project, it was budgeted at $10 billion. He did it for $300 million. This year, the cost of a fully sequenced human genome is going to break the $1,000 barrier.
Right.
So that's a big deal.
Yep.
Is it there yet? It's not there yet. But I will tell you what's coming very, very soon, and it'll give you an example. It'll speak to some of the stuff that Peter's doing at the XPRIZE, and it'll give you an example where healthcare is going. Peter just launched the Qualcomm, $10 million Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE. The Tricorder, if you don't remember, was the medical scanning technology from Star Trek.
Okay.
And what this device really does is it's a cell phone diagnostic device. Right now, healthcare costs are through the roof. In places where there is healthcare, in places where there's a lot of, where there's, in Africa, whatnot, there's a massive shortage of doctors, massive shortage of nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Diagnostics is a big problem.
Right.
So you've got a cell phone-sized device called the tricorder that utilizes lab-on-a-chip technology, microfluidics, AI, cloud computing, and a number of other things. Basically, you can spit on this device, you can give it a blood sample or a urine sample. It will immediately analyze your sample, upload the results up to the cloud, and they're building an AI right now. I don't know if people know this or not, but last year after Watson defeated Ken, what's his name, at Jeopardy, with the first AI to do so, and the big deal there is understood natural language, they sent Watson to medical school. So right now, AIs are being trained to diagnose illness better than board-certified doctors, and they understand natural language. So put this in the device. Suddenly, anywhere in the world, if you're sick, you can cough, spit, or pee on this device, and you know, within seconds, you have a diagnosis. That's a huge, huge step forward. And I, you know, Peter introduced this competition. I'm going to get this number wrong, but he introduced it about 3 months ago. I think there's already 160 teams registered. I could be wrong. It could be 120. But the response has been massive.
Here, Steve, I am in complete agreement because this does not require a physics breakthrough. It is merely a miniaturization question. There's no reason in the world why that we couldn't have a chip that reads a urine sample or a sputum sample or, as you said, or a blood sample, and then immediately get the number of what it is and then report it to doctors. That's a technological problem, but that's something with, like you said, 120 smart teams working, a big financial incentive. I'm betting that that's really smart. So, dear listeners, if I were at all interested in this and I was looking at being at the ground floor, there is something I would bet on. Ask yourself, what role could you play? Maybe you're not a PhD in biophysics and are not going to be able to be one of the teams developing this thing, but maybe further downstream when it becomes available. Are you a marketer? Are you a writer like Stephen is, a science writer? Where could you fit in downstream in the development of lab on a chip? Be knowledgeable up front so that you, when it becomes ready to move into manufacture and or development and or publicity, you can be on the ground floor. Does that make sense, Steve?
That makes a lot of sense. And there's massive opportunity. One of the things that we didn't talk about a second ago, but you know, on another side note on this, suddenly pandemics, which, you know, the more networked we get as a world, the worse pandemics get, right? Scary problem, not going away. If this tricorder device recognizes something that it's never seen before, data immediately goes to the CDC.
Great point. Now, you also talk about the use of robots. Let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemcom. My guest is Steve Kotler. He's co-author with Peter Diamandis. Peter Diamandis, by the way, is the founder and head of the XPRIZE, which awards millions of dollars to entities, anybody, it could be a garage innovator, to anybody who's got a great solution to a major societal problem. The book, I think, offers tremendous tips for all of us who want to be in the ground floor of the next big thing so that we have more job security than we currently have. So your book talks a lot about robotics and how robotics will be a very important in everything from surgery to manufacture. But do you worry at all that the increase in robotics is going to destroy too many jobs for people with average ability, below average ability? I mean, the average folks are having a heck of a time already trying to find work that generates a sustainably livable income. What do you think?
I think I got to answer. I mean, I have to answer that at two points. But you raise a very, 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 very real concern. The first thing you have to realize, though, is in the mid 1800s, 2/3 of America were farmers, right? When, you know, we started to move into cities and the farms started shutting down, major outcries, same level of fear, same level of turmoil, end result, we were fine. Now, that said, this is a transition time. We're transitioning to an information-based economy.
Right.
The upside is that, you know, with a materials-based economy, if I got a hunk of watch and you got a gold and we trade, you got a hunk of watch and I got a hunk of gold. Sorry, tortured that.
Got it.
But in an information-based economy, if I have an idea and you have an idea and we trade, we each have two ideas. So it's non-zero. So the upside is, you know, it's an economy that's not based on scarcity principles. It's based on information. The upside is really, really big. The downside is the transitions are very rough. What I do believe, you make a very good point, right? Robotics are going to take away a lot of our, you know, blue-collar jobs.
Right.
And it's going to happen, and there's really nothing we can do about it.
Right.
two things are going to happen. One is we are, in the long term, going to slowly start to enhance our bodies with technology. Mm-hmm. This is going to happen. We're going to start bringing, we're already very intimate with technology. We're going to start bringing it into our bodies. It will massively enhance our abilities. This is going to open up a whole new raft of high-level jobs. That's the first part. The second part, I think, that is worth talking about is that right now, in a very weird way, but very relevant for your listeners, it's kind of a dangerous time if you want a very safe life. Average 35-year-old is going to have 7 jobs between college and that age. I mean, that's an incredible amount of change and transition. And I think if you want the 2-car garage, the wife and the 2.2 kids right now, and the same job for your whole career, that's a scary place to be. But if you can move with it and adapt and grow, the possibilities are immense, and the possibilities for chasing your dreams today are better than they've ever been. I mean, that's what long tail economics moves us towards, right?
Steve, I got to push back here big time. I'll tell you why. Because unlike in the farming era, to be a winner in coming up with a technological idea needs a tremendous amount of brain power that most people don't have. I'll give you a good example. I just was on the phone with my lifetime best friend. I know 50 years. I met him in second grade. And he's got a daughter who's very diligent and very smart. And she recognized that she needs to become technologically savvy. So she's at Tufts, and she took computer science. And she got A's in everything else, but when she was always taking like sociology kind of courses. Soon as she got computer science, even though she had tutors, she studied 5 hours a day. She just couldn't get it, and she had to drop it. There will be a small number of jobs for the creators, but unlike farming, where you needed in the 19th century millions of people to do the farming, you only need a few brilliant innovators, and most people simply, if we're really honest, certainly the quote bottom half of America or the world is simply not going to have the brain power to be an innovator, and robots are going to replace their job. And therefore, it is in my judgment, what's going to happen is that all of us are going to need to do three things. We're going to need to lower our standard of living. There's going to be a lot of redistribution. The rich are going to pay a much higher percentage in taxes. There's going to be a lot more private charity. We are just going to recognize that unless we go into a truly a pure socialist world, we're going to have to voluntarily or through progressive taxation, we are going to have to subsidize the poor if we want to be humane to that bottom half. Do you agree or disagree?
I disagree, and I'll tell you why. And it kind of contradicts some of the stuff you said at the beginning. But I think when we define poverty, it's a moving target. You have to think about what's happened in the past century. For example, in the past century, human lifespan has doubled. Maternal mortality has dropped by 99%, infant mortality by 90%. Groceries are 13 times cheaper than they were in the 1870s. It's the most peaceful era since, the 500 years ago. On and on and on and on and on. These things go. So I really believe in our core thesis in the book that the basic necessities, you were talking about standard of living, so that's where I'm jumping in, the basic necessities, food, water, energy, shelter, health care, education, are going to continue to get cheaper. That's what we've seen over the past 100 years.
Yep.
Through massive ups and downs, right? Think about how many millions of people died between, the Spanish flu in 1918 and the end of World War I. Massive death, but we still saw exponential technology continuing to grow and these things continuing to get cheaper. I think the second point, and I think this is more critical and it's going to get us into your favorite topic anyways, is education.
Right.
You are right, by the way. She had 5 tutors and they were hammering computer science into her head and it wasn't working. I think two things. One, I am a macroscopic learner. Education systems, and this is a personal experience, education systems are microscopic to macroscopic. They teach you the bits, and then after, a decade, they try to start to put it together for you. I don't learn that way. I was pretty dumb until I got out of grad school even and had an experience that, basically exposed me to macroscopic systems-level thinking. And within, 6 months, I was learning subjects that had baffled me for years and years and years. The reason I make this point is we've got an education system that is 150 years out of date. It's a standardized system. It treats people like cattle, basically. We go to certain classes, bells ring, we go to our next class. We're graded. Everybody's graded on the same curve. Everybody's taught the same way. Everybody's tested the same way. Now we're trying to get that to happen. and it doesn't work. We're all individual learners. That's, by the way, what the Gates, one of the things the Gates Foundation discovered, right? These top-down initiatives have a lot of difficulty working because we have individual learning styles. What is happening now and where this is changing and why it's worth talking about is not only can you get access to, you know, whatever education you want online now for free. The Khan Academy has 2,200 videos up. They're being translated into all the major languages by Google. They're going to crowdsource the translation into, you know, every language imaginable. That's coming. And if you don't like learning via the Khan Academy, there's video games. Some people prefer tangential learning, which is what video games are great for. Those are coming. We are hacking what Csikszentmihalyi called flow states. Flow states are those moments in time when you totally merge into the now and you're fully present and time slows down and you're very focused. What we know now is not only do these things kind of underline creativity and enhance innovation and everything else, but they massively accelerate learning and memory, and we're getting very good at flow technology. Pretty soon we're going to be making video games that are as addictive as current, you know, video games, learning-based, and that once we cross that point, I'm not so sure what people aren't going to be able to learn. So whether or not fundamentally I disagree with your statement. As a journalist, I've been around the world four or five times. I have been in villages in Madagascar in the middle of the rainforest where nobody spoke English. They've barely seen white people before, and I've explained particle physics to people. Don't ask, it's a long story, but my point is I have discovered over my lifetime that there are no dumb people. There are just people who speak different languages, and if you can get it into the right language, anybody can learn anything.
I don't agree at all. I need to go on record, and we'll move to education in a minute.
Okay.
I have spent a lot of time in the schools, both as a teacher, a trainer of teachers, as a PhD evaluator of education, and I have looked, and reality, you know, maybe your Maasai warriors who you talk with could teach particle physics, but I dare say that it's not a learning style issue, it's not a matter of turning quantum mechanics into video games, it sure isn't a matter of Khan Academy, because I have taken Khan Academy courses and watched people. Unless you are a very academically oriented, extremely motivated person, you will not learn algebra with Khan Academy. And, you know, for what it's worth.
Well, you won't learn algebra with Khan Academy the way the education system is set up right now, but look at what they did in the Los Altos school district.
Los Altos is not the world. I want to move off this because we're running out of time here. The other thing is you kept talking about how we're going to have increased longevity, and you were implying about the nanobots, and we're going to, in the genetic engineering, we're going to live longer. Well, the more our population, of course, and given that it's going to take a relatively small percentage of people to create these innovations, and the implementation of the innovation is going to be robotic, we're going to have more people living longer. It's going to be harder to employ a large percentage of the world. But I want to turn to education.
Mm-hmm.
This time I'm going to present an idea to you because I have obsessed about education for, 30 years. This is my field. It seems to me the biggest roadblock in terms of quality education, I know I'm going to offend teachers here, is the teacher. Let's take algebra, there are 30,000 algebra teachers. Some are fabulous, some are average, and some are poor, and it's a difficult-to-teach subject, and the people who tend to go into mathematics are people who are not particularly verbal on average. So you have a group of people who are not that great at teaching it, teaching a very difficult subject, and what many people would say is a gateway to professional employment in the future. Why do we not? Why is there not a simple fix, just like I love your lab on the chip idea? Why is the following not the fix? You take a dream team of the most transformational, that's the word I like to use, most transformational algebra instructors in America, 3, 4, 5 of them, who produce way above expectation growth in their students. You put them in a room with a great interactive video developer, as you said, games, etc. You have them create the ultimate interactive course that can be done at multiple paces, etc., multiple learning styles, whatever, but you create one course, you put it up on the cloud. And then every school district, rich from Los Altos Hills down to the most low-income Appalachian, from Maine to San Diego, can have those classes available to every kid, rich and poor, and they can support with a person on a campus who's there to provide the human touch, answer questions, but that way every kid, and amortized at an extremely low cost, because that's amortized across the whole nation. Why is not that the real answer to our education problem?
Well, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think, I mean, you're taking the two things that I like most, right? The Khan Academy idea, not the actual way the Khan Academy is taught, because again, I'm a macroscopic learner. It doesn't work for me. I watch those videos. I'm just as lost in subjects I know. Mm-hmm. I can get just as lost. But if you harness the power of the best educators, tie it to the best video game innovators, the best developers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and start building these things for different types of learners. Now you're talking. Now it gets really, really interesting. And I think, I mean, we're here now, right? Solomon Kahn was just a guy, was a hedge fund manager, right, who started making videos for
his cousin.
Niece,
yeah.
Right? Anybody can do this. Everybody knows how to do something, right? Anybody can start posting, you know, the how-to videos. I like your idea. I think there's a way we could crowdsource it, too.
Right. I agree completely. That's fine.
And I think Peter's been looking for an Education X Prize for a long time, and I think you should talk to him.
I think I should, too, to be honest. I'm really frustrated. I really think this is the answer, and I'm looking, you know, anyway, let's move off this. I want to talk about water and food, because those are the most basic things, and still most of the world does not have adequate food and water. But I want to let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Stephen Kotler, co-author with Peter Diamandis, who is the founder of the XPRIZE. It awards millions of dollars to solutions to major societal problems. And there's a book that this distills a lot of what they've learned about what is likely to work in the future and therefore help you, my dear listeners, get in on the ground floor to help your career. The book is called Abundance. The Future is Better Than You Think. And as I said, my guest is Stephen Kotler. Let me invite the listener. Maybe, you know, I wanted the listeners to get at least a call or two to get a crack at you if they've got a question or comment. So, dear listeners, if you have a question or a comment for Stephen Kotler, co-author of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, we've been talking about what we think the next ground floor is. He's shared a lot of ideas. I've shared some of mine. What do you think? Do you have a question or a comment? The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now let's talk about, while we're waiting for the calls to come in, let's talk water. What would you bet most of your own money is going to be the technology that is most going to help the world get more of the world get clean water?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, you have to first of all talk about the smart grid for at least a second, right?
Okay.
Because the experts who have looked at this are predicting a 30-50% saving in the U.S. and you know, that in terms of water, and that seems to make a lot of sense to me. But what you really want to talk about here, I mean, there's a lot of cool tech stuff coming, and the innovations are getting really serious. But I think you want to start by talking about Dean Kamen's slingshot, because it's just the most astounding technology. If you don't know about Dean Kamen, he's one of the world's greatest inventors. He's got 440 patents and the National Medal of Technology. Most people know him from the Segway.
Right.
He's really famous for being a medical device inventor, and he was actually working on a dialysis machine. And the biggest problem with dialysis is patients need tons of fresh water. Mm. So he was trying to figure out, and I mean literally, like trucks back up to their houses every week with water, and it's a huge issue. So he was trying to solve that problem, and he was trying to basically take, he couldn't solve it any other way, so he said, why can't I turn tap water into injectable grade dialysis water? Mm. What's the problem? And he started building a device and ended up building both an energy engine to drive it and a water purifier. The end result is called the slingshot. He demonstrated on the Colbert show. You can get on YouTube and check it out. But it basically takes any input, anything wet that you could possibly imagine, including like latrine water, and turns it into injectable grade water. It's 250 gallons a day at less than like 0.02 cents a liter for, I think, the amount of energy it takes to run a hairdryer. And this, you know, this is already, Coca-Cola has partnered with Kamen, this is the most exciting bit, to start distributing it. They've gone through, they did small tests, they're now moving up to, I think it's somewhere between 100 and 400 villages they're going to outfit with the slingshot to see what happens. And if it works there and it looks like it's going to, Coca-Cola is going to distribute this all over the world.
Wow, I love
globally.
It.
So that's a huge, huge, huge deal.
Love it. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with Stephen Kotler, co-author of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. What is your question or comment for him?
Yes. My interest is trying to find a way to keep this optimism in a world of diminishing resources. I just would like to ask your guest how this positive vision fits in with the peak minerals and peak oil and problems that we're having with running out of finite resources.
Steve?
I have to answer that by telling you this one of my favorite stories, which is the story of aluminum. In the 1840s, aluminum was the most precious metal on Earth. Now, this is crazy because it's 8.4% of the Earth's surface, of the weight of the world, is aluminum. But it was rarer than platinum, rarer than gold. The reason the Washington Monument is capped with an aluminum capstone is because it was so valuable. In fact, Napoleon III served when he had very, 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 very famous dignitaries coming to visit him. The dignitaries ate on aluminum utensils. He ate on gold, and everybody else got silver. Very, very rare. It was unaccessible because it was bound up in oxides and silicates. Technology of electrolysis comes along, and suddenly it takes something that is totally scarce and makes it so ubiquitously abundant that we now use it with a throwaway mindset. So while the problems that you mentioned, they're very, very real, you got to think, for example, water scarcity is a really serious problem. But we live on a water planet. 70% of this planet is water. Of that water, 97.5% is salt water. There's 2% locked up in polar ice, and we're basically battling over 0.5%. Cayman's technology, for example, turns salt water into injectable-grade water, drinking water. Anybody can do it. So, again, technology is a resource-liberating mechanism. It turns what was once scarce into what is now abundant. And when you talk about peak oil, I'm not in disagreement that we could be running out of oil. I think the numbers go up and down as to when was the peak and when are we heading there. But I do believe that solar, hybrid cars, all these things, autonomous cars, are coming, going to make a huge, huge, huge difference.
Anyway, thank you for the call. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Steve Kotler, co-author of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. What's your question or comment for him? Hello, it's you.
I was wondering what happens when we run out of salt water.
Okay, I'll thank you for the call, and do you have a quick answer for that?
Well, all the water on Earth is continuously recycled, and being that right now at 7 billion people we use, 0.5% of it, I'm 97.5% is left.
Right. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Steve Kotler. What's your question or comment? Are you there?
Oh, yeah. Hi. Sorry. So I was wondering, I've noticed recently when I was researching just power generation in America that the majority of it uses water-based fuel fuel to heat water and then create steam. I've also learned that the evaporation process is pretty crucial to just purification. So I was wondering if there was any plans on merging the two, since the two seem to be pretty important.
You've actually kind of addressed sort of what Cayman actually did, is he uses a very robust purification process. So that's part of it. I'm sorry, your first question again?
Oh, I've just noticed that most fossil fuel generation power plants also just require,
tremendous amount of water. Yeah, for sure. Fossil fuels are a huge water hog. I mean, nothing really beats agriculture. 70% of our water goes to agriculture. So if you really want to talk about water, you actually have to talk about food.
Interesting.
Anyway, thanks for the call. We are out of time, so I'm just going to ask you one question. You've made a point of focusing on do-it-yourself innovation, innovators, technology, private prizes. I noticed the conspicuous absence of government and even large corporations. What is your honest appraisal, and what is your co-author, Peter Diamandis, who is the CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation and is, quite an eminent guy. What do you guys see as the role of government and corporations relative to these small do-it-yourself startups in moving forward technologically? Because most jobs, an ever larger percentage of jobs in our society is, it's not really these small companies, although that's been often said, but a large percentage of GDP is government jobs and nonprofit jobs and company jobs. What do you see as the role of government corporations versus these small startups as we move forward in this technological future?
Before I answer that question, I want to tell your listeners, by the way, Peter and I both feel that having this new vision of the future is so important that we're giving away the first chapter of the book on our website. So if you go to www.abundancethebook.com, we have the first chapter there, and we have a whole lot more. In answer to your question, which was,
what do you see as the role you focused in our discussion about?
Both Peter and I are in agreement here. Both of us, governments can't keep up with exponential technology. That's what we're seeing over and over and over again. It doesn't work. Large corporations, legacy corporations, can't keep up with exponential growing technology. So we really do think if we're going to raise global standards of living, it's a project that involves everybody. Abundance is possible, but it really means all of us. It means a level of cooperation like we've never seen before. That said, there is some really interesting innovation in government. For example, the Obama administration has, consulted with Peter, and they are now using prizes to drive innovation in almost every branch of government. Mm-hmm. So there is, there are ways that government can start tapping into some of the exponential trends that you're seeing in business. It isn't happening enough at this point, and I don't think both either Peter nor myself are entirely hopeful that it's going to happen in the future. But I think that's where you're at. I think that the DIY innovators can do, great things at this point.
I think that's pretty exciting, and I hope for you, my dear listeners, that there is optimism. Whether or not you're going to be the big innovator of the next technology or be further down in the pipeline, I hope maybe some of the ideas that Stephen has shared might help you in at least your long-term career planning. Steve, thanks very much for being my guest on my show. The book is Abundance. The future is better than you think and do. And again, thanks for giving me part of your Sunday, Steve.
My pleasure, Marty. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye. Okay, and now in the last, we have about 10 minutes left, but I always want to, where I can, have time for you with your questions about your own career. If you would like a 3-minute, what I call a career makeover or workover, I don't know which is a better name, but if you need career help, this is the time to call. We only have about 10 minutes left. The phone number here for one of those is 415-841-4134. That is on Work with Marty Nemco, which is what you're listening to here on KALW, 415-841-4134. I had, I'm going to share a couple of just little thoughts that popped into my brain. I'm an atheist, but I also believe it's very important for me not to, just be ignorant. So I have read the New Testament recently in the last couple of years for the first time. And if I were to, and I looked at it, as a guy whose life is about work, I'm a career counselor, I read the New Testament with an eye towards seeing what are the lessons that the New Testament has for work, regarding work. And in essence, it seems to me, and of course we can't reduce the Bible to, or the New Testament to a soundbite, but it kind of the core messages around work are: be humble, surrender your faith to God, do not be willful, the meek shall inherit the earth, God will provide. Then I asked myself, is that really the advice I would give to my son or daughter? Especially in the, not when the Bible was written, but now, be humble, surrender, God will provide, do not be willful, the meek shall inherit the earth. I don't know. So I just raised that question. So let's go to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again. If you would like a 3-minute career makeover, you've got a work-related problem, I will be happy to take a shot at it. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. How can I help?
Hi, Marty. I'm working on a startup, and I've also got a regular 9-to-5. Wanted to know if there's any suggestions for telling my employer about working on the startup, the best way to go about that relationship and making sure that they're okay with it.
What makes you feel that you need to mention it?
There's some legalities to it. I mean, if I need to be careful about doing it on nights and weekends, for one, not using company resources.
Right. So and this is not rocket, this is not profound, but my way would be to simply say something like, I would put myself, as I always try to do, and I recommend, and everybody, whether they're writing a resume or giving a speech or talking on the radio, put yourself in the shoes of the listener, and in this case, your boss. ask him what are the reassurances that he would need up front so he doesn't have to raise objections, because once he starts raising objections, you're oppositional. Instead, simply list all the legitimate objections he might have. For example, shared intellectual property, that you're going to not be spending enough time at work. Make a list of all the things that you think he might object, and preface your request for his blessing with that information, so he realizes you've taken his concerns into consideration. And then, depending upon his personality, either put your request in writing or meet with him informally, depending upon him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that was good advice.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Yes, hello. I am a teacher who may be on sabbatical next year,
mm-hmm.
and the purpose of my sabbatical is actually precisely to get a new vision of education without sounding cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And so I listened to one of your shows, and it was really about how much you can learn outside of universities, et cetera, which is my kind of inclination.
Right.
So I have three questions. I'm just looking for a little bit of orientation towards. So my questions are, you know, what are we actually doing in education now? What should we be doing? And where are we truly headed? So I'm just asking you for maybe some starting points. This program has given me some starting points, but okay. Any ideas that you have for a teacher who's been teaching for 20 years and is trying to get out of the classroom to get a better vision,
okay.
What's going on with technology, what's going on with achievement, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, let me ask you, so I want to focus you, because education is a very big thing.
Yes, it is.
Is there a particular kind of teaching that you do or want to do? Are you interested in young children? Are you looking at interested in
I'm
low
achievers? High school,
low achiever? Are you mainly interested in low achievers, high achievers?
I'm definitely interested in the achievement gap.
So low achievers.
That is the buzzword these days.
Yes.
So I'm really interested in the fact that we have low achievers who are being told that they are supposed to go directly from high school into a four-year college.
Great.
And so, my classroom doesn't.
So that what I would be doing then is I'd be looking at innovative programs for that are alternative right now. Exactly right. That is the method. The general message is got to go straight to college.
Right.
So what I would be, you know, you start, and as anti-intellectual as this sounds,
right.
Google, because it is the font of so much of the wisdom of the world.
Yeah.
I would Google the word post-secondary in quotes, and then low achievers, terms like at risk, and see what, and model programs, and see what you can learn simply by Googling and reading, and then. My wife is commonly known to, has known to, who's the superintendent of schools in Napa County, and she's on the state superintendent's cabinet. She says a model program is one you haven't visited, because very often what's in the glossy brochures and the websites and the grant applications and the reports,
yeah.
there's a grand canyon of difference between that and what really plays out in the real world, and,
right.
and we visit it. So what I also don't dismiss all model programs.
Right.
So after having done that Googling research, mm-hmm. if you find a couple of programs that titillate you, that make you say, ah, that's fabulous, that's interesting, use some of that sabbatical to make visits to those programs, and do not let them just give you the dog and pony show. I have to tell you the story.
Yeah.
We, like Barbara and I, like most people, were very excited when we saw two different 60 Minutes features on what was called Central Park East. Central Park West is a very upscale part of New York. Central Park East is, you know, is really not, it's Harlem, it's a poor area.
Right.
And there was this woman, Debbie Meyer, who created this fabulous program. So when we made our next trip to New York to see my mom, we made a point of making an appointment to go and visit Central Park East, this huge model program that was supposed to make enormous differences.
Uh-huh.
Well, they wouldn't let us in. And uh-huh. the principal came to the door and says, I'm sorry. We then tried something. We said, you know, we are well aware
uh-huh.
that model programs in reality are a lot tougher. We are both educated. We've both been in the classroom. We're not expecting to see perfection.
Right.
Tears came to his eyes.
Mm.
And he let us in.
Mm.
And he showed us what a nightmare it really was. And that said, there was this Debbie Meyer was a very charismatic, fabulous person. But you can't have a scalable program based on one amazing person. And he says, actually, it's been a couple of years since the cameras have been in, you know, when Debbie Meyer was here, and now our test scores are back to where the district average is, you know, or the average for similar schools. There is a lot of problems. And he was in tears. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not saying all programs are like that.
Yeah.
But education is a very tough game.
I know.
And especially, you say, for low achievers, because there's so many factors that,
yep.
that contribute to low achievement.
Right.
Family factors, family of origin factors, peer factors, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Economics, everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you, I want you to visit model programs.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to read what the Gates Foundation is doing.
Yeah.
I want you to Google to find out the greatest, new, exciting visions. You might indeed want to read the chapter in that book, Abundance, on, because he's got a chapter on education.
Mm-hmm.
And then make some visits and visit with open eyes, not getting the dog and pony show. Does that
right.
make sense?
Yes, totally.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemco. We've got time for one more call, so let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. How can I help you?
Hi. I have kind of a, like a weird background or a mixed background. I'm, I guess what Americans call, I'm like generalist and what is it, master of none, something.
Right, a jack of all trades, a master of none.
Yeah. I have a mechanical engineering degree when I came to this country, and then I worked as an engineer for years, left for 2 years. Traveled solo, hitchhiking through Africa for a year in Asia, so I used to be quite a bit of a curious and adventure seeker. Got an MFA in SFAI, doing installation art, ended up working at the Exploratorium, had a big bad accident, ended up doing software because that's all I could do for a while. So I have tech, art, programming, sort of education, project management kind of background, and now I've just been doing software design, and I'm really fed up with it. So I would like to find something that kind of mixes my background, and I'm not really sure where to go. Some people have suggested move to L.A., do animatronics for film. I just don't really know where to go now. And public art, you know, I'm not sure where to apply what I have and where to start doing the networking. I feel very insecure, that kind of thing.
I'm going to propose something. We're almost out of time, but here's my first just intuition. You know, things like museum and performance art, you know, installations, they're too risky. There's too few jobs that pay a sustainable wage.
Correct.
I'm wondering whether you might want to get into the world of packaging design, because packaging requires an understanding of mechanical engineering. There's certainly an aesthetic component. It's three-dimensional, which you implied you liked. There's certainly a project involved. I wonder whether developing innovative, it could be ecologically packaging or just very attractive packaging or something, might incorporate all those skills. What's your first reaction to that?
I think that I would still have to take some classes because
sure.
my AutoCAD background is not very good.
Sure. But anyway, that was just my thought. I'm looking at
yeah.
the clock. We're out of time. You know, that would be a way to, it seems to me, practically integrate your art interest, which obviously tends to be pretty powerful for most creative people, as well as without ignoring your mechanical engineering and programming and project management background.
Can you suggest somebody who might be able to give me a little bit more guidance?
No, I don't. I don't know. But I would Google packaging design training,
okay.
packaging design journals, packaging design publications, so you can find out what the cutting edge of that is, and that will either make you more enthusiastic about it or less, and maybe give you the names
okay.
of some people. Does that make sense?
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers or workovers on callers. And I invited KALW listeners who have had a career with lots of embedded lessons for all of us to contact me if they'd like to appear on the show. And this coming Sunday, it'll be Brian Jones, kind of an accidental entrepreneur who has had to face quite a few personal challenges. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. We'll be right back.